Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More at dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and this is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our subject today, why did the Wisconsin uprising fail? Why did the demonstrations, the massive petition drives, the mobilization of union members, and the recall elections end with Governor Walker still in power and the Republican Party in solid control of both the State Assembly and State Senate? My guests today are Paul Gilk and David Cass, the editors of a new book of 14 thoughtful essays on the subject, essays with a progressive political slant, called A Whole Which Is Greater, Why the Wisconsin Uprising Failed. It's published by Whip and Stock of Eugene, Oregon. Joining us by telephone from his home in Texas, one of the contributors to the book, Jim Veninga, a professor of religion and former UW-Marathon County Dean. We're also going to be listening to the words of four of the other contributors to the book, Mike McCabe, the director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, Margaret Swedish, a Milwaukee author whose family goes back many generations in this state, Eric Yonke, professor of history at UW-Stevens Point, and Jeff Lee, associate professor of history at UW-Marathon County. We want to stress that all three of our academic guests today are speaking for themselves and not as representatives of the UW system. Well, you can speak for yourself as well if you have opinions on the Wisconsin uprising, and I suspect you do, opinions on why the recall elections failed, why they didn't succeed. Give us a phone call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Paul Gilk, David Cass, Jim Veniga, thanks so much for spending the next hour with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us here.
Let's start with the obvious questions. Paul and Dave, what motivated you to put together this volume?
Well, I was following the news 2 years ago, Governor Walker's initial bill to strip public sector unions, and then the massive uprising, people coming into Madison to protest. Also, at the same time, one has to remember that there were events going on in Tunisia and then in Egypt. So there was,
yeah, we had the Arab Spring going on at the same time.
Exactly. So there was a big hunk of news that had to do with uprising. And so I was watching this for a while, watching the thing grow, and one day I just called David and I said, you know, I think maybe we should solicit some people here and get some essays together and see if we could put a book together on this subject.
Well, you've got 14 great contributors. David, what were you trying to accomplish? Were you trying to accomplish anything?
Well, the idea originally was Paul's, but I think the idea was to get Midwestern writers. All the writers are from, I think, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and to get Midwestern writers to give their feelings of what was going on, what's the state of things is. So Paul originally asked us to use the Scott Walker election and the demonstrations afterwards as a springboard, but we didn't have to address those. The writers didn't have to address that particularly or directly. It was to give a sense of what's going on in the state, in the country, internationally.
Well, how did you two select the contributors? There are 14 very thoughtful essays in this book.
Well, some of them either David knew or I knew personally, and some I knew because I had been introduced to them by David, Margaret Swedish, for instance, and Dan Griggle. Jeff Lee from the university here I knew independently. I knew Jim Veninga somewhat, not terribly well. Eric Yonke from
UW-Stevens Point.
Stevens Point, yes, I knew personally and had known a number of years. And then there were older friends, Maynard Kaufman from Michigan, who's in his mid-80s, whom I'd known for going on 30 years, as well as Rhoda Gilman from Minnesota, who was very active there, not only in the Minnesota Historical Society, but had been a lieutenant governor candidate for the Minnesota Green Party. So these were people I had known a long time and trusted their perceptions and trusted their writing capacities.
Jim Veninga, what got you interested in contributing an essay to this volume?
Well, I had been thinking a little bit about the conditions of 100 years ago, the early progressive movement, and looking at the conditions of present-day United States and Wisconsin and seeing some similarities there, and that kind of drove me to ask some questions about the nature of progressivism as it first developed, and especially questions about the religious framework that helped sustain the progressive movement.
Well, the essay is entitled, Can Religion Help Revive the Progressive Tradition? But most of us in America, at least at this point in time, we're most familiar with conservative evangelical fundamentalism as the point at which religion intersects with politics.
Well, the interesting thing, if you go back 100 years ago, what you find is that progressivism was very much a movement that involved people from various political parties, independents, Republicans, Democrats. Indeed, one of the hallmark books that has to do with Wisconsin progressivism, the book by Charles McCarthy called The Wisconsin Idea that was published 100 years ago as an introduction by Teddy Roosevelt, Republican. And he, of course, applauds what's going on in Wisconsin.
So he was applauding then-Republican Senator Fighting Bob La Follette.
That is
in
correct.
That introduction.
That is correct. So, you know, that's a key here, is that there was a very big tent that was developed to bring people into this movement. So the question for me really was, if there can be a new progressivism, what would it look like? And might it be possible to get beyond the politics of division that we have experienced, and the very thing that you talked about of the religious right having such a loud voice and bringing people together to really work on pressing issues.
Well, people forget that there was a very strong progressive tradition in the Republican Party, starting with Abraham Lincoln, going through Teddy Roosevelt, Bob La Follette. What happened?
Well, World War I happened, for one thing, and it lost a lot of steam at that point. And in the 1920s, in spite of the roaring stock market, there were undercurrents of deep unrest, the Ku Klux Klan, racial tensions, and all of that worked in a way to kind of undermine the progressive movement. And then, of course, the Great Depression hit. But, you know, the interesting thing is that that progressive voice never was lost. I mean, you see it. You see it in the Catholic worker movement in the 1930s with Dorothy Day. You see it in regard to the civil rights movement. You see it in the New Deal. You see it in parts of Lyndon Johnson's platform. And many of those initiatives, civil rights is a good example, involve people from both sides of the aisle and independents. So, you know, I remain an optimist in that sense, that potentially a new progressivism could emerge, and one that could somehow bring people together rather than divide them.
Well, we had the influence of the Catholic Church, or at least a segment of it, in the last presidential election, the Nuns on a Bus, Sister Simone Campbell.
That's right. And they draw on a long tradition within the Catholic Church concerned about social justice issues. So there's a real heritage there within Roman Catholicism, just as there is within Protestantism.
Jim, I wonder, this is Paul, would you talk a little bit about Walter Rauschenbusch and the role he had in all this?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Walter Rauschenbusch was a Baptist minister, one of the key proponents of the social gospel, and it was the social gospel or social Christianity that really served as the intellectual framework for progressivism. And Walter Rauschenbusch, once he graduated from theological school, took a church in what was called Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan, New York. And it was there that he experienced for the first time what it meant to be a part of the working poor. He saw the tenement houses. He saw poor sanitation. He saw children who were being left behind and abused. He saw political corruption. And he went to work as a Baptist minister to try to rally people to deal with those problems. What he concluded theologically was that a message that focused only on personal redemption was inadequate, that you had to talk as well about social transformation and social redemption.
Now, didn't he write a book back at the turn of the last century called Prayers for the Social Awakening?
Yes, he did. That was one of his books, A Theology for the Social Gospel is another one. He was the major kind of thinker behind the movement and such a champion of progressivism.
The conclusion you reach is that, let me know if I'm putting words in your mouth, Jim, but the conclusion I got was that if the progressive movement, this new progressive movement, is going to succeed, maybe it needs to be similarly grounded in religious faith.
It does. I think it has to be a different kind of religion than what we found 100 years ago. That was mostly driven by mainline Protestantism. So it's got to be much broader, not only in the sense of drawing from that rich Catholic tradition, but also from the Jewish tradition and from all the new religions that have contributed to making the United States the most, you know, diversified religious country, really, in the world. So, you know, Buddhism and Hinduism and a return, too, to the truths of indigenous religions. So I think there is a wealth of religious faith there that can really enrich the framework that could support a new progressivism.
And this really is a much more diverse country than it was when Walter Rauschenberger was writing.
That is indeed correct. But there are parallels in terms of the kinds of overriding issues that we have now and they had then. The gap between the economic elite and everyone else was so prominent at that early period in the progressive era and was an effort to counter it. And we see that now, the gap between the extreme wealthy and the rest of Americans. There is a middle class crisis, just as there was at the turn of the century, 100 years ago, that is, a real deep concern about the future of the middle class. And certainly, if one looks back, you also see a loss of the common good that the progressivism sought to try to counter. And I think the same thing might happen again today, or at least that's my hope.
And I misspoke. That's Walter Rauschenbusch.
That's correct.
Who,
Walter.
Wrote Prayers of the Social for the Social Awakening. Jim Veninga, who has contributed an essay for this new volume that's come out on why the Wisconsin Uprising failed. We've got not only Jim but the two editors, Paul Gilk and David Cass. The book is called A Whole Which Is Greater: Why the Wisconsin Uprising Failed, published by Wipfenstock of Eugene, Oregon. And we'd like you to join the conversation. Why do you think the recall elections failed despite the millions of people who signed petitions, despite the mobilization of union members? If you've got an opinion or a comment, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742.
I'd like to put in a very short plug for the book. The publisher, Wipf and Stock, that's WIPF and Stock, STOCK, has said that they will give a 40% discount on the book if you order online from the company using a discount code, which is the word uprising, which comes from the subtitle. So if you purchase the book online using the discount code uprising, the price will be marked down from $30 to $18. That's just a quick plug there.
All right, very good. As I said at the top of the hour, we do want to get to some of the other contributors who wrote essays for this volume. We're going to start out with Mike McCabe. He's the director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. His essay is entitled, Who's Awake in Clark County? Now, McCabe grew up on a family-owned dairy farm in Clark County. He writes about how the county turned from a bastion of progressive politics to one of the most conservative parts of the state, and about how the Democratic Party in Wisconsin has lost the support of poor rural voters.
Clark County has changed a lot politically. It used to be a bastion of progressivism, and now it's a very conservative place politically. And what's happened with Clark County speaks to a bigger problem that the Democratic Party faces. The Democrats have forgotten how to appeal to people in rural parts of the state. And I think the recall elections should have been a wake-up call.
You write in the essay that you heard from your dad, the Democrats were the party of the poor and the Republicans the party of the rich. But yet the Republican Party now has a lot of poor people supporting it through the Tea Party movement.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, if you look at the 10 poorest counties in the state of Wisconsin, all but one are counties that pretty regularly vote for Republicans. And Scott Walker carried those counties collectively by a wide margin in the recall election. Clark County is one of the five poorest counties, and yet Governor Walker won by a 30-point margin. And so what the Republicans have done is they've built a rich-poor alliance.
How have the Republicans managed to drive a wedge between the Democratic Party and what used to be their strongest constituency?
Well, you know, the Democrats used to stand for policies that touched every single family anywhere in America. You know, when you think about the GI Bill, it touched every single family in some way. You look at rural electrification, certainly affected everybody living anywhere in rural America. And, you know, increasingly the Democrats have become seen as the party of government and particularly the party of public employees. And a lot of people in Clark County, for example, don't get the pay and don't get the benefits of many public employees. The Republicans have been able to exploit that very successfully. They're able to go out to people in rural areas and say, you're paying for something that you don't even have yourself. And I think that's a big part of how they've been able to build this rich-poor alliance that's resulted in a strong Republican majority in the state at the current moment.
Do you think the Democrats are going to turn it around?
Well, you know, I think the Republicans, you know, have a growing problem across the country just in terms of demographics. They're increasingly being seen as sort of the white man's party, and they are having trouble appealing to women voters. They're certainly having trouble appealing to minority voters, and those minority voters are getting closer to being a majority all the time. So the Republicans have got that challenge demographically, but probably the best thing they have going for them is the Democratic Party.
That's Mike McCabe, the director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, one of the contributors to this book of essays on why the recalls failed, a book called A Whole Which Is Greater. Paul, Dave, either of you want to comment on what Mike McCabe just said?
Well, I'll make a couple comments. I agree with him fairly much completely. I think the Democratic Party has pretty much become another party of power. There's still talk. There's still some of the more liberal talk. But in fact, the corporate influence, the money influence, the lobbying influence, and the promotion of large unions, nothing against the unions, but again, without looking at the small people who are ununified, that kind of thing has made the Democratic Party also a party of big money. And I think that there's no way they can hold on to the poor reasonably, just what Mike McCabe said, as long as they're in that camp.
Jim Veninga, you spent you know, your whole career in an academic background. How do you react to Mike McCabe's analysis that the Democratic Party is failing because it's become the party of public workers, teachers, people with these nice contracts and pensions and health benefits?
Well, I think he is raising a very serious question, and one of the themes that seems to emerge in this book, if there are themes, since the essays are so diverse, but is that a politics of self-interest has really come to dominate American politics, as Dave was just talking about it. And you can begin to slice that and say, okay, what is the self-interest of the Republican Party and what is the self-interest of the Democratic Party? And within that question of the Democratic Party, I think you do have to point to what Mike was talking about. From the other side, it is, you know, the perception really that big business and the economic elite, they're the ones who are benefiting from the Republican Party. But the danger to American democracy is this politics of self-interest. So the question becomes, whether you're Republican or Democrat, how do we get beyond this so that we can think in terms of the country as a whole and all of its citizens?
1-800-780-9742. That number again is 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to Rich in Phillips. Rich, you're on Route 51 with Dave Kass, Paul Gilk, and Jim Veninga.
Yes, hello. Thank you for the program. I think there's a couple of points that I'd like to make
I believe the recalls did actually have an interesting outcome. Senator Lehman from Racine did win, and I think it put the Republican agenda on hold for a year. And also, I think the teachers heading to Madison on a Friday, I think if they would have delayed going until a Saturday, I think they would have had a lot more support. I think initially there was a lot of people that were upset that a lot of schools were closed on that initial Friday. Those are the comments I have to make.
All right, Rich, thanks so much for the phone call. Gentlemen, any reaction?
Well, we had to come up with a subtitle, or felt we had to, and one that would be topical and grab people's attention, which is why it is why the Wisconsin Uprising failed. Or, if we had said why the Wisconsin Uprising hasn't succeeded yet, would have been a little too murky, I suppose, for people to grab onto. But in some respects, the uprising by no means is over, any more than the Arab Spring is over.
1-800-780-9742, Dave Cass, Paul Gilk, the editors of a new volume called A Whole Which is Greater, Jim Veninga, one of the contributors. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, building the local economy and strengthening the community by making local business everybody's business. More about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
If you just joined us, this is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg. My guests, Paul Gilk and Dave Cast, who have written a volume of 14 essays on why the Wisconsin Uprising failed. The book is called A Whole Which is Greater. We also have Jim Veninga, the former dean of UW-Marathon County, who contributed an essay on progressivism and religion. He's joining us from his home in Texas. Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Wes now in Sun Prairie. Wes, you're on Route 51.
Hi. I do quite a bit of traveling in my work, and especially to a lot of smaller towns. And during that time when they had the recall election, there were a few things that I heard almost everywhere I went, and one being probably one that I heard more than anything was, hey, Walker was elected. Why do you think you can just turn around and take him out of office without finishing out his term? It was almost like people were just indignant that you felt like, you didn't get your way, so you're going to try to change something and not work within the system. That was one thing that I heard. And then a lot of other things that I heard were like, well, why does Madison think that they can speak for the rest of the state? Because a lot of the people in the rural areas seem to not feel that, Madison is really representing the people in the rural areas. And then on the subject, the third thing I heard is on the subject of the unions. I didn't really hear anybody against unions in general, but a lot of people were saying that, when you have, public, the unions in the public sector, they negotiate for what they want, and that raises our taxes, and there's no competition, and people were a little bit against that, not unions in general, but just the fact that, when it's hitting their pocketbooks. And that's what I heard more than anything, rather than people just really trying to stick to party lines.
All right, Wes, thanks so much for you just gave us a lot to chew on here. Thanks so much for the phone call. And gentlemen, as a reporter, I heard many of the same things myself.
Well, I'd like to address those things. Actually, I heard the same thing, too. I'm a teacher. I worked up at Nicolet College, just retired this year. And, in fact, I remember one faculty member talking to another and saying, what's this recall about? And, of course, a progressive, so-called progressive, could say, well, doesn't he know what's going on? But the question he was asking was exactly the question that was raised. Walker was elected. He wasn't accused of accepting illegal donations in this, or fraud, or some kind of illegal activity. So he's in 1 year. Why can't he finish his term? And so that very comment I heard from a number of people also. One of the contributors of the book, Dan Grego, told me that he thought the recall was a mistake. He actually voted for it because he didn't like Scott Walker, but he said he thought it was a mistake that the Democratic Party and the people who were protesting should have just concentrated on the national election that was coming up. And it's also true, I think, that a lot of people in the northern part of the state feel that the larger population of the South, Milwaukee and Madison particularly, can sometimes dominate elections and act as though they speak, although people did come to these demonstrations from all over.
Let's listen to some comments from Margaret Swedish, another one of the contributors to this book. She's a Milwaukee-based author whose new project is Spirituality and Ecological Hope. Her essay is entitled What's Really Going On in Wisconsin. In it, she writes about growing up in a Republican family with deep Wisconsin roots and how our state's politics have been poisoned, in her view, by excessive partisanship and the influence of big money.
I started sort of immersing myself in the story of my own family history here, my deep multi-generational roots here in Wisconsin. My father was a friend of Senator Joe McCarthy. It was a very Republican family, very much part of that aspect of the Wisconsin political culture. As I grew up in the 60s, as many of us, I went through a lot of changes that made me question that worldview. So I've been very intrigued by the polarization, the political polarization going on in the state. Because in many ways that polarization has been part of the characteristic of a state, its political culture, for a long time.
We are the state of Joe McCarthy. We're also the state of Gaylord Nelson.
Yes, well, Joe McCarthy and fighting Bob La Follette. I mean, you can't get much more bipolar than that. And yet in the past we've had sort of these very interesting moderate leaders, people like Gaylord Nelson, who was respected in many ways across the political dividing lines. Warren Knowles, sort of a moderate Republican who was once our governor. We had a tradition here of a sort of civil kind of politics, even though at times you could really see the polarization expressing itself.
Do you worry that civility has been lost?
We can't even talk to each other.
In your essay, you write about the failure of the uprising and the recall elections, and you talk about the influence of big corporate money.
Yes, ever since the Supreme Court Citizens United case, we've seen this incredible influx of money into these secret operations, these secret PACs, where we don't even know half the time who the donors are. A lot of the big donors are corporate-related, and they have their own agendas. And one begins to ask this question of who our elected politicians are actually responding to. Are they responding to the good of the whole population, or are they responding to these donors whose money they need in order to win an election? This is becoming a crisis of democracy all across the country, and it certainly is here.
If there's anything you'd like to add, please do.
I just want to emphasize the point I make at the end of the essay, which is that even though, you know, the subtitle of this book is that why the uprising failed, I'm not sure it's failed forever. I think it actually has caused a lot of people to become engaged in politics that hadn't been for a long time. It kind of woke us out of a lot of inertia. It's going to be some years before it works itself out, but I think there really is a rebirth of democratic participation in the state because of what happened in 2010.
That's Margaret Swedish, one of the contributors to the new book of essays on why the Wisconsin uprising failed. The book is called A Whole Which Is Greater. Jim Veninga, her comments there at the end seem to echo what you were saying about a new progressive tradition.
I think so, and she's on to something there, to try to figure out what can be done so once again we can sit down at the same table and talk to each other. The Citizens United decision, she's right there. That has undermined the democratic process, and I think is a significant danger. So the question really is, what can be done? What can we do as citizens to try to counter that? How can voices be heard? That's the, one of the success points of the so-called uprising is, as she was saying, citizen engagement. So anytime we see engaged citizens, you know, that is a plus. But countering the big money influence, that is a major problem.
We have a phone call on that subject from Larry in Kingston. Larry, you're on Route 51 with Jim Veninga, Paul Gilk, and Dave Cast.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. The Republican Party have enough corporate money where they can buy states now. They tried buying the presidential election, but they're not quite there yet. If people don't wake up, they're going to be buying all elections, mostly local elections, though. And the ad that the National Rifle Association put out against Barrett right at the end and put up these signs all over the rural area that Barrett was going to take their guns away, that swung a lot of votes. Because if you talk to people where I live, you know, they say the Democrats are going to take my guns away and I ain't going to be able to hunt no more. And that's just the way it is.
Larry, thanks so much for the phone call. I want to take another call right now because we've got callers stacked up. Let's get a contribution now from Valerie in Friendship. Valerie, you're on Route 51 with Dave Kass, Paul Gilk, and Jim Veninga.
As I said, I'm a Democrat. Voted for, signed the petition, voted for Walker. Why? Because who in the world nominated Barrett? I thought the lady was running and winning. And all of a sudden, he got the nomination. I looked him up online. What does he stand for? I'm for education. What does that mean? I'm for the unions. What does that mean? I couldn't find out what anything meant. So I looked up Walker, and I voted for him.
Valerie, thanks so much for the comment. Gentlemen, Paul Gilk, do you want to respond?
Well, I'm not sure how to respond exactly to Valerie, except to say that it seems politics is full of cliche and full of phrases that appeal to whatever sentiment the audience wants to put onto those phrases. I mean, the contentlessness of American politics is pretty astonishing. But I would like to chase this question about polarization back a little bit. And to some extent, I feel like I'm channeling the social critic Kevin Phillips, who used to work for Richard Nixon way back in the 60s.
He's the one who wrote the book, The Emerging Republican Majority.
Yeah, right. And that was, with 1960, I think the watershed event was 1968.
Not too much. You went off topic.
Well, let's address Valerie's topic. Valerie, you're upset that Kathleen Falk didn't win the primary.
She was ahead. The unions were behind her. What happened?
Okay.
How did Barrett, who lost against Walker before, get the nomination?
I think you have to be a political insider to answer that question, and I'm not a political insider, so I don't have an answer for it.
Valerie, thanks.
I don't either.
Thanks so much for the phone call. We really appreciate
sure.
it. Paul, why don't you conclude what you were the thread you were on?
Well, just that Phillips said, with 1968, with two things. One, Lyndon Johnson signing into law the civil rights, various civil rights acts of the mid-1960s, after he was freely elected in 64. That combined with the Democratic Convention in 68, which seems to me, as Phillips was saying, turned a huge portion of the white working class against the Democratic Party. And then we began to see a steady exit from the Democratic Party of the white working class, including a lot of unions, or union members, I should say. The union leadership stuck with the Democratic Party, but a lot of the union members walked.
Now, my memories from 1968 is that the demonstrations, the anti-war demonstrations, turned off a lot of conservative Democrats and a lot of working class people. Did we have a parallel with the anti-Walker demonstrations in Madison? I mean, there's a certain thread in American politics where people just don't like people who stir things up.
And also, I think part of that is the people who are stirring it up were perceived to be people who were well-paid, upper-middle class. Not all were. I mean, not all were. You know, some of them are just park workers, public employees who do not make a lot of money. But a lot of the teachers, like myself, were paid very well, had very good benefits, which we didn't even have to pay for. So we didn't have to pay our health insurance. We didn't have to pay our pension. That was paid by the school. And so I think a lot of the demonstrators were perceived as just whining upper-middle class, which is unfortunate. But the fact is that the working poor were not there in very large numbers. Now, there were some farmers came in on tractors, things like that. But I think that overwhelming majority of the upper echelon educated and things did turn a number of people off.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our subject today is a new book of 14 essays entitled A Whole Which Is Greater, Why the Wisconsin Uprising Failed. We have Paul Gilk, Dave Kass, who edited the volume, and also Jim Veninga, who wrote one of the essays. We're going to listen to the comments of another contributor, Eric Yonke. He's a history professor at UW Stevens Point, and again, his remarks are his own. They do not represent the UW system.
Really what I did was I tried to write up an essay using the most recent scholarship on history of fascism to talk about what its conditions are and why it came about, particularly in Europe in the earlier half of the 20th century.
You know, we in America, when groups, whether they're conservative groups or liberal groups, disapprove of somebody, they tend to label them as a fascist and a Nazi. You saw that happen with Barack Obama, and we saw that happen with Scott Walker. What's the danger of doing that?
One of the obvious dangers is that it makes the term meaningless. The term fascism does have a real specific, you know, set of meanings, both historically and even just in terms of politics. And to smear somebody in American politics, you know, with that label really kind of ignores, you know, all of the realities of, you know, what protections we have under the Constitution and the fact that, you know, we've got people, both Republicans, Democrats, and others, political parties that work within a democratic constitutional framework.
But yet fascism came to power in very economically well-off, intellectually well-educated societies. Is there a danger that it could happen in America, or are there other things that we should worry about more?
You know, I think we do run the risk of limiting our basic constitutional rights. I mean, I'm very much worried about the Bill of Rights and what's happened. The use of drones right now, for instance, without due process. What happened under the Patriot Act, a real suspension of our basic rights under you know, our Constitution. And the other thing I would add to it that I worry about is the kind of culture of fear. And the fascists were very good at cultivating that sense of fear. When we make decisions based on fear, to sort of suspend our rights, to protect us in that sense, and that's really dangerous.
And you also write that one of the things that you're troubled by in modern American society is the lack of participation by so many people in the political process.
Democracies require an informed and an active citizenry. And the more that we sort of ignore, or the more that we throw up our hands and say, oh, we can do nothing about it, the less that we are willing to engage in the democratic process, the greatest danger is that we hand over our rights as citizens to others who will make decisions for us.
That's Eric Yonke, who wrote a passage on fascism and democracy in this new book of essays, A Whole Which Is Greater. Jim Veninga, Eric Yonke, expressing some concern over the loss of civil liberties, unaccountable programs like drones, the politics of fear, and then an apathy or a lack of participation in the political process.
Eric uses in his essay the term democracy deficiency, and I like that. That is that the real threat is citizen apathy. So the way to counter the prospects of what he is talking about, I think, really have to do with an active democracy in which citizens truly are engaged and where everyone is welcome, somehow to learn again to listen to people, and I think that's what Professor Yonke is really talking about. He, you know, he says the hard work of democracy is never truly complete, and I agree with him.
Gentlemen?
Well, basically, I agree with Eric, and the apathy, and I've been guilty of it to a certain extent myself. I think that's part of it, and the incivility that Margaret Swedish talked about, I think is very important. And the use, examples of that are the use of the word racist and fascist and Nazi. I mean, calling Barack Obama a Nazi or a fascist or something like that. Or Scott Walker again. We still have our civil liberties, but they're being drained to a certain extent. Out of fear, again, I think that's a perfectly accurate, you know, assessment of that problem.
And the point, I think, is that when, you know, when we have this incivility and so many people get turned off from the political process, well that allows a minority of wealthy people to make all the decisions, doesn't it?
Well, this the question of incivility is partly whether you look inside the country or outside it. I mean, say with Reagan and the arming of the folks in El Salvador, the death squads, or the forming of the Contras to overthrow the Nicaraguan Sandinistas, you know, that's quite uncivil in the usual sense of the word. But as long as our uncivility or our incivility is pointed outward at people we deem inappropriate, we don't seem to mind.
And again, that brings up his comments about the drone program.
Yes, very much.
1-800-780-9742. The book is A Whole Which Is Greater, Why the Wisconsin Uprising Failed. Let's go to Matt in Wausau. Matt, you're on Route 51.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call and for the show. The thing that I think we're not stressing here strongly enough is the amount of money that Scott Walker had to play with in terms of the recall. I've heard figures anywhere from 8 to 10 to 1 in favor of Walker, and arguably most of that money coming from out of the state. I think that obviously made a big difference. I mean, if you do the numbers, and it's not hard to figure out, Scott Walker paid almost $30 for every vote he got. And that's something pretty hard to overcome. I think there was a lot of people on the streets working pretty hard, but at the end of the day, the mass media kind of ran that election, in my opinion. And I'll leave it at that, and thank you for taking my call.
Matt, thanks so much for the phone call.
Yep, bye.
Well, I'd like to make a couple comments, not directly on what Matt said, but something that hasn't been mentioned yet, but that is mentioned in the book by quite a few authors, in particular by Maynard Kaufman and by Margaret Swedish. And that's the economic situation we face, which is for which what happened in Madison is just a tiny blip. And I think Maynard Kaufman mentioned this to Paul Gilk. He was mentioning this last night, that he mentioned that this uprising in Madison is a blip, and these people are mainly interested in just their salaries or their benefits. They're worried about themselves, but they don't realize that the entire world's in economic slump. It's not just an economic slump. We're overconsuming. We're destroying the planet's ecology, its environment, and that this can't go on indefinitely. There's limited energy. There's a lot of people. We're all going to have to learn to simplify. So Maynard Kaufman's article is not so much about Harry Madison or that uprising. It's about what we have to do to change the way we live if we're going to survive in the world without huge catastrophic change. And one of the things he mentions is climate control, and Swedish Margaret Margaret Swedish mentions global warming. And so these kinds of issues that are mentioned by several of the authors in the book have not been mentioned today yet, and I think these are huge things of which the Madison uprising was ignorant or did not take part in, and so it was perceived as a self-interest movement in many ways, and I think these have to be addressed.
You know, the whole idea of the politics of climate change, despite what all the scientists say, despite what all the climate scientists in the world say, despite the ice caps melting, the acidification of oceans, the bleaching of coral reefs, island chains that are being inundated, Hurricane Sandy, and Jim, where you live, how many days of 100-degree-plus temperatures did they have in a row in Texas last summer?
It broke a record, and the wildfires are proof of all that.
And despite all of that, people say it's not happening. You have top political figures in our government who deny that it's happening.
Well, that does reflect the distrust of government, doesn't it? That somehow we have developed a deep-seated fear of government and a distrust of government. And, you know, whether or not it began with Ronald Reagan, who said government, you know, is not the solution, it's the problem, others can debate that. But something has happened over the past 30 years to undermine confidence in government, in government officials, in federal agencies, in state agencies.
Jim Veninga, one of the contributors to a new book of essays called A Whole Which Is Greater. We also have the book's editors, Paul Gilk and David Cast, with us. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. And let's listen to the words of yet another contributor, Jeff Lee, who is an associate professor of history at UW-Marathon County, and he was overseas in Lebanon, studying when all of this was happening, when there was a concurrence of anti-government demonstrations in the Arab Spring uprising and the anti-government demonstrations of the Wisconsin uprising. Again, Jeff Lee speaking for himself, not as a representative of the UW system.
It was a remarkable experience. As you know, this was going on exactly at the time that the Arab uprisings were beginning. And so I was sitting in Lebanon getting information on what was happening in Tunisia, what was happening in Egypt.
And oddly enough, what was happening in Madison, Wisconsin.
Were they aware of what was happening in America in the heartland here in Wisconsin while they were going through all of that turmoil themselves?
Right. Well, I was at an English language university, and so we had staff that were Lebanese and from other places in the Arab-speaking world, as well as Britain, Canada, the U.S., and Australia. And so it was a very international group that was reading the news every day on the Internet. And what, of course, surprised to all of them, as well as me, is the degree to which the governor and his allies were trying to change the way that public employees were treated in Wisconsin and how strong the reaction against it was. And so they were rather amazed to be thinking of a place like Wisconsin, which has a reputation for good governance and a reputation for compromise, really being seen in a similar light to what was going on in the Middle East, where you had absolutely despotic regimes being addressed in far more dramatic fashions by their own public. You know, not to say that either quantitatively or qualitatively that these things were on the same scale, but rather that there was, you know, analogous public anger at what a sitting government had done. And so they were really surprised that we had this kind of problems with bipartisanship here.
Problems with bipartisanship.
Well, I agree. I agree again with Jeff Lee here, and it's very interesting to think that all of these things were occurring at the same time. I want to continue on something that Jim Veninga said. He said that this lack of trust in the government, or in not necessarily even just the government, but of the word of scientists. And I remember when there was a scandal that some climate scientists may have modified some of the results or kind of squeezed the numbers a bit to make it come out that there was global warming. I think later on it turned out that what they had done was relatively minor and was really not political in nature. But in any case, this lack of appreciation or lack of respect for experts, for scientists, for the government also, you know, where it comes from exactly, particularly for the scientists, I'm not sure. But one thing has to be said, and I think this is the point that I mentioned before, it's not just lack of trust in the government. I don't think the government alone can fix these things unless the government is supported by the people, but the people have to look themselves at what's happening with climate change.
How do you, gentlemen, how do you react to people who say this is just sour grapes? People want conservative government in Wisconsin. They voted for Scott Walker not once but twice. You held your recall elections, and they ended up voting for Republicans in the state assembly and state senate all over again by an even larger margin than before. I mean, face the facts. People want conservatives running the government in Wisconsin.
We're part of the problem, a huge part of the problem, is that we need a new politics that addresses the seriousness of the nuclear arsenal and the seriousness of climate change. But to seriously address those issues means we have to radically downsize our economy in a green direction. The Republicans are dead set against this downsizing, and the Democrats are afraid to address it.
Paul Gilk, Dave Cash, Jim Veninga, we're out of time. You've got 15 seconds for a final observation, if you'd like to make one.
Well, I want to make one quick observation. I'm sorry for this little plug, but the profits for this book, by the way, if there are any, are not going to any of the authors. They're going to Voices for Creative Nonviolence in Chicago, Kathy Kelly's group.
Jim Veninga?
I'd like to return to Jeff's big point, and that is the need to strengthen the public sphere and ensure there are safe public spaces where true dialogue can take place.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. It has been a fascinating hour. Dave Cast, make your plug again. Go ahead for the book Uprising, use the code word.
Right. If you use the code word Uprising and order a book online from the publishers, WIF and Stock, in Eugene, Oregon, you can get a 40% discount from $30 to $18, and all profits for the book are going to Voices for Creative Nonviolence in Chicago, led by Kathy Kelly.
Our guests, Paul Gilk and Dave Cast. The book is called A Whole Which is Greater, Why the Wisconsin Uprising Failed, published by WIF and Stock of Eugene, Oregon. Joining us by telephone, Jim Veninga, one of the contributors, also. Thanks to Mike McCabe, director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, Milwaukee author Margaret Swedish, professor of history at UW-Stevens Point, Eric Yonke, and associate professor of history at UW-Marathon County, Jeff Lee. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Next week on Route 51, it's a salute to Valentine's Day. Thanks for riding along with us today, forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And until next week, we are heading out of town.